Welcome, everybody. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and you're at the Right Now Mastermind class for June 2014. I am delighted to welcome Aurelia J. Schultz as our guest today. Aurelia J. Schultz is an intellectual property attorney who counsels clients on protecting and managing their intellectual property portfolios. She has experience with both sides of enforcement, like website terms of service, contract negotiations, copyright and trademark registration, and litigation. Her clients include startups, small businesses, and independent creators. Aurelia is a member of the Wisconsin and California State Bars. She graduated from Carroll College and received her law degree from Vanderbilt University. She's a member of the Executive Committee of the Intellectual Property Law Section of the California State Bar. You can visit her online at schultzlaw.us. And if you're interested in that website, I'm going to be sending it out at the end of the week when I send out the link to the recording. So you'll be able to access it directly from there. So welcome, Aurelia. It's really good to have you with us.
Thanks, Rochelle. I'm very glad to be here. Thank you for welcoming me to your program.
Well, it's fun to have you. So I'm going to just say one more time to the group, if you want to mute yourself, you can do that by pushing *6, and that gives us a little better quality line. And then, Aurelia, my first question for you is, how did you get into intellectual property law?
Okay. This is a fun story for me to tell. I always get very excited about it, so hopefully I won't go too fast. I got interested in intellectual property law when I was living in Zambia. I was there with the Peace Corps. And there was a Zambian musician that I really, really liked. His first album had been a big hit, and they had announced that his second album was going to be coming out soon, and he had his launch date, and we were all waiting for it and really excited. And then they announced, oh, it's postponed, it's coming out later, here's the new date. And then they pushed the launch date again, and they pushed it again. And then finally they said, okay, the album's not coming out. And we were all really disappointed, and I was wondering, you know, what happened? Why isn't this album we've all been waiting for coming out? And it turned out that the artist had sampled R. Kelly's Bump and Grind in one of the tracks on his new CD that was supposed to come out. And he had gone ahead with the production of the full album and then discovered that he was denied the permission to use it. So he couldn't use the track. The album was stuck, so they basically had to start over on producing the album. And that got me really interested in, you know, what happened, what could have gone differently, who deals with these issues. And I found out that's an area of law called copyright, and that particular issue was something called copyright licensing. And so I got interested in intellectual property, decided I wanted to be involved in that, and went to law school to pursue that.
Wow. That is so interesting. So I just have so many questions because I talk to clients and other writers about this stuff all the time. So I guess my first question is, what is the difference between copyright and trademark?
That's a great question because that's one that I get a lot. So copyright is the area of intellectual property law that covers creative works. So your writings, your books, your music, songs, paintings, any sort of artwork like that, anything that you've created. And then trademark is the area of intellectual property law that covers logos and brand names and the ways that you identify a product or a service.
Okay. That's interesting. And then, what do I get with a copyright? Like, what does it entail me to? Hello, everybody. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this is the Right Now Mastermind class. I got bumped off the conference. Aurelia, are you still here?
I'm back. I got bumped off, too, but was able to get back in on a different line.
Okay, great. So what I'm going to do is kind of start over again just for the benefit of our listeners. Now we're getting some feedback. So if you're on the phone and you're not speaking, if you could push record by pushing *6, that would be awesome. And I will, yeah, I don't want to start muting people because I'm afraid I'm going to mute Aurelia. So we got horrible sound today. So let's keep going and hope it goes. I'm going to do a little intro and then we'll go back to to Aurelia. Hi, everybody. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this is the Right Now Mastermind class for June 2014. I'd like to welcome Aurelia, who counsels clients on protecting and managing their intellectual property portfolios. And hopefully we can splice in the old intro, so it's all here. So Aurelia, we were talking about copyright and what we get with copyrights. So do you want to talk a little bit about what we get with copyrights?
Sure. So I'll recap the little bit I had gotten into that before we all dropped. Yeah. So what you get with copyright is actually a bunch of rights, and it's commonly referred to in the lingo as a bundle of rights, sort of what you can think of it like you have a bundle of sticks. And there's four main rights that you get with your copyright, and those are the right to reproduce, the right to prepare derivative works, which is things like adaptations, and then the right to distribute copies, and the right to publicly display or publicly perform the work. And with each of those rights, you have the ability to sell or rent or share any of those rights as you see fit. So if you think of it as that bundle of sticks, you can give other people sticks or let them borrow sticks or things like that. And that's what you get with the copyright, is that group of rights.
Okay. So can you repeat those again? Just, you know, like me, we were going, oh, my gosh, what's that? That's amazing.
Okay. So the four main rights that you get with a copyright are the right to reproduce.
Okay.
The right to prepare derivative works. The right to distribute copies.
Okay.
And the right to publicly display or publicly perform the work.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So if we want to take our novel and turn it into a play, we can't do that unless we own the copyright.
Correct, because that would be a derivative work.
Okay, got it. So, you know, one of the things I hear a lot is, well, you don't need to register for a copyright. Just mail yourself your poem or your novel and don't open it, and that's copywritten. Is that true?
I hear that a lot, too. That's actually, it's not true, but I can explain why that's kind of a common myth. That comes from the old Copyright Act. So that comes from what we call the 1909 Copyright Act, which was in effect until 1978. In 1976, Congress wrote our current Copyright Act, which is called the 1976 Act, and that changed how a person obtained a copyright. So the only thing now that mailing your work to yourself like that and then leaving it closed would do, that does provide some evidence about a date by which you had created the work. But if you think about it, especially with most things being done on computers and things, there's a lot of other ways that you can show when you created something other than mailing it to yourself.
Okay. Yeah, that is very old-fashioned. So if I wanted to get a copyright, and obviously I'm not going to mail myself a letter anymore, what can I do?
So under this new 1976 Copyright Act, you actually have a copyright as soon as your work is fixed in a tangible medium of expression. That's the official language, the fixed in a tangible medium of expression. And so I like to think of that as soon as your work is put into some sort of form that can be shared without you being part of it, you have a copyright in that. So if you take, for example, a novel, as soon as that novel is put on paper or on your computer file instead of in your head, you have a copyright. Now, the issue is that in the United States, you cannot enforce that copyright in court until you register your copyright with the U.S. Copyright Office. So that's why it's a good idea to do the registration. And it's pretty easy to do a registration. They can be done online. It's something you can do yourself or that you can have an attorney help with. And if you're working with a traditional publisher, generally the publisher will actually go ahead and do the copyright registration.
And would it be okay? I mean, should we bother to register our stuff before we're done, or should we wait till we're done to register our copyright?
Generally, it sort of depends on how much you're putting out there. So if you're not going to be releasing the work to any place where anybody can find it, it makes sense to wait until it's done. If you're kind of posting constant updates, maybe writing in live time on a blog or something like that, then maybe you might want to register part ways, because the issue is the registration, I like to think of it like insurance. It gives you the ability to bring a suit
should you need to. So if the likelihood of there being a suit because nobody has access to your work is null, then it wouldn't make sense to register something mid-work.
That makes sense. So this is a random question, but if I'm, working on stuff and I want to show some people, like in a critique group, or if I want to start sending it to agents, what I often see is writers, just putting copyright in their name. Does that do anything? Is that helpful?
It lets the other person know that you're aware that you have a copyright in your work.
Okay.
And it can, especially for those who aren't super familiar with copyright law, it can act as a discouraging agent in terms of preventing copying, because people go, oh, this is copyrighted, because they don't often realize that it's copyrighted even without that symbol. So it kind
okay.
of puts people on notice and gets you a little bit better behavior from most people.
Okay, that's great. Well, I want to talk a little bit about licensing, because this is something, right of publicity, because this is something I hear a lot from writers. So if I'm writing a memoir, or I guess even a nonfiction book where I'm telling the stories of real people, what do I need to worry about? And again, I'm just going to say before you answer, really, if anybody's on a phone that might be loud, go ahead and push *6 because we're getting quite a bit of feedback today, and it could be the weather, it could be like Mercury's in retrograde or something like that, but it would just help. Okay, so back to right of publicity. What do I need to worry about if I'm going to write about my Aunt Marge? And I don't have an Aunt Marge, but...
But if you did.
But right. If I did.
Anytime you're including real people in your writing, then you're dealing with an area that's called either right of publicity or personality rights. And what's interesting about these is, unlike copyright, which is a federal law that governs the whole country, right of publicity or personality rights are state by state. So you
okay.
have different rights in each state. Now, what I like to do, because most people who are trying to publish are not thinking, oh, I'm only offering this work to people in my state. They're thinking, I want this work to be available to everybody in the country, if not the world. So what I tend to do is say, you want to look at the state whose laws are going to be the strictest in this area, where you're going to need to pay the most attention. And for the United States, that's California.
Hmm.
They have the strongest right of publicity rights. And so... the key is, there's a couple key issues. One is, if you're writing a novel where it's sort of based on a real person, but you're not really talking factually about that person, you need to think about whether or not the general public will be able to identify who that real person is. So if you're not writing Aunt Marg's biography, but you're writing a novel where Aunt Marg is kind of your inspiration for the novel, as long as the public's not going to figure out that it's your Aunt Marg, then you're in good shape. That's kind of the key thing there. If they are going to be able to figure out that it's your Aunt Marg, or if you are doing something like Aunt Marg's biography, then you want to make sure that you avoid two things. One is, you don't want to invade their privacy, and
okay.
the other is that you don't want to defame them. So invasion of privacy is where you're making offensive information available to the public when it's not really any of the public's business. So there's kind of an exception for things that are newsworthy. But if you're talking about, some horrid thing that's going to reflect very poorly on Aunt Marg, and there's really no reason anybody needs to know it, then that's going to be an invasion of privacy, and you don't want to include those sorts of things. Defamation is something that harms the person's reputation, but there's kind of a general rule with defamation: the truth trumps the harm, because these rights, while we're trying to protect somebody's privacy and protect them from this defamatory harm, we also have in the U.S. a very strong right to free speech under the First Amendment. So the way this works in the law is, they're trying to balance an individual's right to privacy with the general public's right to free speech. So you want, the rule is, if it's true, you're generally in good shape, but if there's no reason for the public to know it, then you might want to leave it out anyway to avoid the invasion of privacy.
Wow.
But on the defamation side, as long as you're true, you're in pretty good shape. You want to beware of placing real people in a false light, so making it seem like they've done something or are somebody that's not accurate.
Okay. So what, you know, I mean, I think I'm just going to follow up a little bit because I'm thinking, you know, what if I'm a memoirist and I want to write about a difficult experience I had, I don't know, maybe as a teacher or whatever. And so I'm going to be talking about some of my colleagues and some parents and so forth. And, you know, I'm not sure what the, you know, I probably would have to check my contract to see if that was legal. But then after that, or even talking about my marriage, how does that work? To me, like, nobody really needs to know any of this stuff. It's just that I want to talk about it. I want to write about it.
Right. So the main thing, the first thing you want to do is make sure that you're really doing your fact-checking so that anything you're including about somebody else is true.
Okay.
You don't want to make sure you're not, if you're purporting that this is a true memoir, make sure it is true. You don't want to have things in there where somebody's going to come and say, "That's, I'm defamed because that didn't happen and it reflects horribly on me and I'm not really like." And then make sure that the things that you're discussing are relevant to the story you're telling. So, for example, if you're talking about, you know, difficulties you had with another, you know, teacher, going back to your teacher memoir idea, saying, you know, this person did X horrible things at home, you know, maybe they kicked cats or something like that, that's not going to be relevant to the relationship you guys had at work that you're trying to talk about.
Okay.
So that's where you want to make sure that the information you're including makes sense in your story and is important for your story, not just extra things that make somebody look bad or invade their privacy.
Okay, that makes sense. So you're not going to be like, and by the way, they also did this and this, or so I heard. That's
right.
Not good. So does it matter if the real people we're talking about are famous relatively famous, like they are public figures?
It does. It matters in two different ways. It actually helps you out a bit if you're trying to do a biography type thing, because famous people are public figures, they sort of get less protection in their lives, which, you know, you can argue whether or not that's fair. But it's very difficult for a public figure to win a defamation claim because there's actually a higher standard. In addition to showing that they're harmed, that their reputation was harmed, and that the stuff wasn't true, which is what a normal person would need to show, they also have to show that the person who put this information out there acted with actual malice. So that if you're writing about a famous person and you say something that's very unflattering and maybe even not true, they have to show that you intended to harm them.
Okay.
So that's kind of, they have a higher standard for that. So you, as an author, you have a little bit more leeway there. And I certainly don't recommend writing things that are false because of that. Again, the truth is always your friend here. And then the other way in which it matters if you're writing about a famous person is you can't appropriate a famous person's likeness for your own benefit. So what that means is, like, if you're writing a novel, you can't make one of the main characters a famous person for the purpose of trying to sell your novel on that person's name, for example.
Okay.
So you can't work off of them.
But could you include them as a character in your book? Because I've seen books, and I think, you know, Lisa Lutz in her series on the Spellmans often includes, and I forget the guy's name, the African-American actor with the amazing voice. She always talks about him and talks about wishing he could make a cameo in her book and blah, 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 or do a book trailer. And I think he's actually mentioned like 6 times in the novel, but maybe not as a character. So I'm guessing it's not a good idea to put someone like Stephen King in your book.
Right. So you can always mention people because a lot of your characters are going to be, if they're set in our world, they're going to be interacting, maybe not interacting, but influenced by, you know, maybe watching the TV shows with these people or something like that. So it's totally fine to, like, mention them and have them exist in that sense. What you don't want to do, the standard there is just to remember you can't appropriate their likeness for your benefit. So you need to look at how you're using their likeness. Are you using it to try to get some benefit for yourself?
So what if they're dead? How dead do they have to be before you can put them in a novel? I know it's a crazy question.
No, that's actually an excellent question, because this is one place where, remember I said California state law is kind of the strictest in this area. Unlike the rest of the states, although I'm not positive on New York at the moment, California protects dead celebrities as well as living.
Okay.
So if you want your book to be sold in California, you want to stick with the same rules for dead and living, because you just don't want to get into that quagmire with that state.
But I'm guessing that if you're writing, I think there have been tons of novels out now about pretty historic figures like Lincoln.
Right. Yeah. I mean, at that point, you're getting pretty far back. And technically, so this is where state law gets goofy. For somebody to take advantage of California state law, they would need to have this enough connection to California, generally being a resident or a citizen of California. Citizen of the U.S., but residing in California.
Okay.
And that's not going to be everybody. That is going to be a large chunk of our modern celebrities.
Okay. That's interesting. Wow. This is stuff I never knew. So it's a good, I better scrap my novel based on my favorite celebrities of the 1980s or something like that. So I want to talk about licensing. And tell me what does it mean to get a copyright license, and how does that work?
Sure. So a copyright license is basically what it means is you kind of have, I like to think of it like you have a rental agreement. If you have a copyright license, you're renting the rights in that license for whatever period of time is in the agreement. So it means you can have some of the rights, some of those copyrights that we talked about earlier, where you've got the bundle, you might have all of them, but for a certain location or a certain time. So what the license means, if you have the license, it means you have the right to use the work that's licensed in the way that's outlined in your license agreement. If you're giving the license, it means you're giving another person the ability to use your copyrights in the way you've outlined in the agreement for however long you've agreed upon.
Okay, so that would be like if I had written a novel, I might give a license to a movie company to use the story to write the script. Is that
right? So you could give them you could license your right to make derivative works.
Okay.
To allow them to develop a screenplay and a movie based on it, that's a great example.
So, okay, so now I want to talk, kind of the details of what do I look for in a license grant within a publishing contract. So let's say I'm kind of one of those people who wants to publish traditionally, and obviously this will be in my publishing contract. So what are some of the things that I need to be aware of? And I know there's tons of subtopics in this, so if you want to just kind of go through, or I can prompt you, either way is fine. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'll start out. If you have questions on anything, just jump in and we can get
okay.
more into an area. The first thing you want to look at when you get a licensing agreement or an agreement with a publisher, you want to look at whether you're granting a license or an assignment. And the difference between a license and an assignment is that a license is basically a rental, and an assignment is a whole-out sale of all of your rights. And that's it. They're gone. They're the other person's now.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to check whether you're granting your publisher an assignment of all of your rights or you're licensing your rights to them. Now, you can still have a license that licenses all the rights, but they technically still belong to you. They're just on loan or rented out to the publishing company. So that's the first thing you want to look for. You then want to look at what's being licensed. So is it all of your rights worldwide indefinitely? Is it all of your rights worldwide for a limited time? Is it all of your rights but only in the United States? Is it just the rights to copy and distribute copies? Do you keep your derivative, your right to make derivative works? And if you are, and you had mentioned, Rochelle, that, okay, you're somebody you want to do other publishing too. If you're granting an assignment or you're granting a license to all of your rights, it's a good idea to ask for a license back for your own use so that you're not infringing your own copyright because you've given these rights to the publishing company if you should do something else with your work. So, for example, if you want to have the right to print other copies of the work for some reason or use it in specific settings or keep the derivative works for certain situations, so you want to look at getting a license back to be able to use the work for yourself if you're granting the publisher all of the rights.
And how do you do that?
The questions are, and for a lot of the issues here, it's going to be how do you do that? Check. You want to go through your license agreement, and this is an area where I think anytime you're going to sign something, it's a good idea to sit down with an attorney and go through it. Look to see if that right's already in there. It might be that they've already included that because it's asked for enough. If not, say, you know, I'm happy to grant you all these rights, but I would really like a license back for these particular uses. And you kind of go back and forth and you negotiate. You say, I got the contract, I looked it over, it looks great, but I would like X. And then you try to, you work on it until you can get that in. And the license back is one of the things you'd want to look for.
There's more. Okay, so we're going to go to that in a minute. I just want to say to our listeners, this is really important when it comes to the little assignments you do now. So often we're willing to do work for hire assignments that are basically you grant the publisher all rights to everything. And you know, we sign that and don't realize that maybe at some future date we're going to want to use those characters in another work, or we're going to want to use an excerpt of that in a longer book. So that's when you're starting to think, you need to start thinking about building a career and how this is going to impact your career later on. And this is why you'll often see in the front of books, you know, that the author thanks and gives credit to all of these places for allowing them to publish their own work in book form, because no doubt those people have hold some of the copyrights to that. Does that sound right, Aurelia?
Yeah, that's a great point. And a work for hire, if you're doing something as a work for hire, you're actually, the company that is hiring you gets all of the copyrights. You don't even have a copyright in it. So that's definitely a place where you want to ask for a license to your own work.
Yeah, and really think about, you know, how, because they hold all of the intellectual property rights. So the ideas belong to them now, right? Is that right, Aurelia?
Ideas themselves are not copyrightable.
Okay.
Only what that, go back to that kind of magical legal language, fixed in a tangible medium of expression. And writing, TV, movies, plays, these sorts of things, there are certain aspects that are sort of standard pieces, almost like the notes in a musical composition.
Mm.
And you can rearrange them and use them in different ways. And even though they might be found in a bunch of different works, or you might have been inspired to use it because of a certain work, that doesn't mean that you can't use it. They're sort of uncopyrightable elements. So you don't lose things that can't be copyrighted, and you don't lose ideas, but you do definitely lose that tangible expression.
Okay, so if I write a short story and have a character named Irma, the bookseller, she's theirs. Irma can't be in my next novel.
That depends. Characters are a little different, and honestly, I don't think that's something I can get into too
much. Okay. Sorry, it's like we have a lawyer. It's like, let's just ask her everything. And I promise I won't talk about my will, but, you know, we're just like, oh my gosh, she's here. So to talk a little bit about you had mentioned just a minute ago about other things that we need to think about when we're looking at contracts. So why don't you talk about those things?
Sure. So there's a couple other big ones. The next big one I'd mention is look at where the territories where you're licensing the work. If a publisher is asking for the distribution right for the entire world, make sure that they have subsidiaries across the world where they can actually distribute. What you don't want to do is grant a publisher, for example, the rights to distribute your work in the U.S. and Europe, and then find out that they don't actually have any way to distribute in Europe, and now you can't give those rights to a European publisher because you already gave them away. So it's fine to license for more territories, but just make sure the publisher actually has the ability to to distribute or do whatever the right is that you're granting in those territories.
Wow, good point. And what other things? I think maybe subsidiary rights, is that another thing you're going to tell me?
Subsidiary rights falls into that. So usually the way publishers work in terms of foreign distribution is through subsidiary and connections. So agreements with other publishers or subsidiary publishers that they have specifically for other jurisdictions.
And so, and what would be examples of that kind of a right?
So, let's see. I mean, I'm not familiar with enough publishing connections to know whose subsidiaries are whose, but one example, I mean, just a generic thing would be if you have a New York publisher that has a London subsidiary for the purpose of distributing their works in London, then, or in the UK, maybe even in Europe from that position, then that would be one where the publisher has a subsidiary connection and you could be willing, like if you're willing, it would make sense to grant them the rights to both the US and Europe.
Okay. And then, you know, talk a little bit about ebooks, future formats, print on demand, out of print.
That's exactly where it's going to go next.
Okay.
One of the things you want to look at in your agreements is what happens when a work goes out of print and whether you're granting rights for only physical copies or including ebooks. You want to make sure that you know what rights you're giving. So if you're happy with the publisher to do the print books and the ebooks, that's fine. If you don't want them doing ebooks, or again, if they don't have a distribution method for ebooks but they're asking for those rights, then that's something you want to negotiate with them. And that relates to when the work goes out of print, because most authors would like the ability, if the work goes out of print, the ability to publish it either on their own or digitally or through another publisher. So you want to check to see if the publisher gets print-on-demand rights. Because if the publisher has print-on-demand rights, that can technically mean that the work never goes out of print. And so if you've got it set that the rights revert to you when the work goes out of print, but they have print-on-demand rights and it's left at that, it could mean that the rights never revert to you because they could always print when somebody requests it. So you want to check things like that and make sure that if you want them to have print-on-demand rights, maybe have a different way of the rights reverting to you or something like that.
Wow. I'm like dizzy. This is why I did not become a lawyer, because this is a lot. And what about the whole future formats? I mean, I know when I started publishing, we weren't quite into ebooks yet, and it was kind of like they were like, you know, putting like weird things, like if it gets published on a starship or every future weird format, we get the right to.
So there's a couple things that play into that. So most agreements will ask you, like in the form that you're given from whoever, they're generally going to ask for those future rights. And it will say something like all methods of delivery now known or invented. Like they'll have language in there trying to say we're going to get everything that we haven't even thought of yet. I'm generally in favor of just asking them to take that out and see what happens. It gets really goofy into whether or not those rights are going to be upheld and what's included. There were issues in the music industry where people had contracts for royalties based on certain things that were signed before there was any sort of digital music distribution. And some of those contracts, it was actually found that the musical artists actually had the digital rights distribution royalty rights. They weren't to the record company with all the rest of the royalties. So those sorts of things, when they're licensed for future uses and those future uses then come up, those are often wind up being disputes in court to actually sort out whether or not those rights really were granted, and if so, were they the same terms as the contract? How are they different? So it can get messy, which is why I suggest, like my view is, just ask to not have it there.
Go ahead.
No, that was it.
Well, and I think, you know, what you're reminding me is that probably we need to, like, take a deep breath. I'm sure that when we all get our book contract, we're like, oh, my gosh, I'm so giddy. And before we sign it, out of fear that they're going to go away, if we don't have an agent to negotiate it for us, then we need to find a lawyer. to look at it. So here's my question. When should a writer hire a lawyer, and what kind should we look for?
Okay. So I think it's a good idea to hire a lawyer anytime you're going to license any of your rights, even if you've just been handed a contract to sign, to at least look over that contract. At the very least, to just go through it with you and make sure you fully understand everything that's in there and what's not in there in terms of what kind of legal repercussions the document might have. If you're negotiating the license to your rights, it's a good idea to have an attorney kind of help with that. And then the other place where I think it's helpful to have an attorney is if you're doing your own copyright registration, at least to walk you through the first time you do it, because it is an online form. It isn't that complicated, but it does ask questions that get to some nuances within the copyright law. And so those can be a little tricky the first time. Once you get a handle on it and you've worked through it with an attorney, you can probably do them pretty easily on your own after that. Or if you just don't want to deal with it, you can have an attorney do it. But the first time, I think it's really helpful to have somebody. And then obviously, if anybody's making a claim against you for anything in your works, you definitely want an attorney then.
And what kind of an attorney? I mean, can I hire my tax attorney to do this?
Well, technically you can, but I don't know. Your tax attorney probably would actually tell you that they don't want to take it. It's a good idea. I mean, just like any area of law, like you said, you weren't going to start asking about wills. You want to look for an attorney that handles the type of matter you're interested in. Mm. So for this sort of stuff, you want to look for a copyright attorney or someone in that area. So attorneys that do privacy work often are very familiar with copyright as well. They overlap. Attorneys who do trademark work are often familiar with copyright. They overlap. So somebody in the area that's generally called intellectual property. And if you happen to get an intellectual property attorney that doesn't do copyright, they will usually refer you to somebody who does.
Okay.
So that's the main thing you want to look for.
And if we're looking for a lawyer, and what are some things that we should look for in a lawyer? What qualities or qualifications?
So the most important quality when looking for an attorney is really how well you can work together, which I know it's not going to show up on somebody's website, we'll work great together, but ask yourself, am I comfortable working with this person? And if the answer is no, even if they're a fabulous attorney and an expert in that area, then they're probably not the right attorney for you, because this is somebody where you two both need to be able to trust each other and give each other information and be able to be frank and honest and really focused on what your goal is and why you're working on whatever contract you're working on or dealing with whatever, claim against you. So it's really important that you feel comfortable with that person and are able to communicate well with them. That's hands down the most important quality. In terms of qualifications, you want to look for somebody who's knowledge and experience in your area, which is kind of like what we just talked about. You want to look for a copyright attorney. You want to look for somebody who's familiar with the type of work you're working on. And you can learn about qualifications on most attorneys' websites about pages. It'll tell you where they went to school, kind of what areas they're interested in, what they've been practicing. And don't be afraid to ask. If you're not sure, you can ask an attorney, how many of X have you done or how often, and ask around with other people you work in your field too, and see who they work with and who they like.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, just anytime you have a question when you're talking to an attorney, it should be an interview on both sides the first time you meet an attorney. So you can decide if you both are actually deciding if you want to work together. And so don't be afraid to ask questions if you have concerns or if there's things you're curious about.
That's good. Thank you. So I want to open it up to questions of our audience. And if you want to ask a question, please push *7 to unmute yourself. And you should be able to ask questions. So if you want to ask Aurelia about the law or a specific feature of the law, go ahead. Anybody have any questions?
This is Donna. I have a question.
Yes.
I have a short story that was published in an anthology, and it mentions Howie Mandel. and it was an actual event that happened between Howie and myself and my guide horse, and it was a little bit of conversation, and wanted to find out, is that legal for me to have him in my story?
Okay, so if we look back at what we went over when we were talking about using famous people in your works and kind of the right of publicity, if you remember, the main thing was, you know, is the information you're giving true? And it sounds
yes.
like you're saying this actually happened. So the information you're giving is true. Does it place the person in a bad light? Sounds like probably not. Plus, it's true. So generally, if you have that truth with a famous person, you shouldn't have any problems.
Okay, yeah.
That's
no, it was flattering info, so.
That's great. Thank you. Other questions? This is a great opportunity for you. And we haven't really talked a lot anything about self-publishing and what you kind of have to think about doing on your own because you're self-publishing. So if anybody has any questions along those lines, go ahead and ask those. If you want to unmute yourself, it's *7.
And Michelle, since you brought up self-publishing, I'd like to just pipe in one thing on that. That's an area where I feel that it's very important to register your work before you take it to the self-publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a horror story on that if anybody wants to hear it. But that's an area where the publisher is not going to register it for you, and you're going to be putting it out there, so you want to have that registration in hand.
Right, and you know, if you're a person who's publishing your own work, even if you're like kind of setting up your own publishing house, you're going to want to meet with a lawyer to incorporate that or do whatever you need to do. And then you're going to want to look at the tools you're using because some of the companies who are lending you their tools are also asking for certain copyright privileges. Or saying, because you're using our tool, we have these rights to your book. And so you really want to check on those things because it's a very messy time right now in publishing. And I am usually so overwhelmed that I don't know. So I would rather have a lawyer look at it for me than to do it myself. And I've heard her scary stories. I think you want to be careful there. So any other questions? You guys are also quiet. So tell us your story about self-publishing and why it's important to register our copyright. What could happen if we don't?
Right. So if you remember back when we were talking about how do you get a copyright, and I mentioned you get the copyright as soon as it's fixed in that tangible medium of expression, but you can't enforce that copyright in court until you have the registration with the U.S. Copyright Office. As an author in the U.S., that rule applies. So there was a gentleman who was working on a very extensive book, had been working on it for many years, and wasn't sure he was going to be able to finish the book before he passed away. He was elderly and had some health issues. And so he wasn't sure he'd be able to get it to the point where he could be shopping it around to a regular publisher. And this was an experienced author who had a number of books published through regular publishing houses, but he decided he was going to self-publish this book in the form he had it in, so at the very least his friends and family could have copies should he not be able to finish it before he passed. And he sent the book off to a publisher. Self-publisher had the contract agreement. The self-publishing company wound up going out of business and being bought up by a different publishing company, and they hadn't bothered to do the book. So he said, you know what, forget it, just let's give it back, give me back my manuscript, I'll cancel my order, we'll just forget about it. So they did that. And then what happened was the publishing company, after he basically revoked his authorization for them to publish the books for him, went ahead and published the book on their own after making some changes to it, kind of cutting it in half, published it on their own and started selling it without his authorization. And he tried to bring a lawsuit against them for this, but they knew that the work had not been registered, and so they knew he could not bring a case in federal court, and you have to bring copyright cases in federal court. That's in the law. And he tried to bring a state small claim court case to kind of argue, well, I had this agreement with them, and they said they weren't going to publish it anymore when they gave it back to me, and they broke that agreement. But because it was a copyright infringement case, really in the center of it. The court had to kick it out. They couldn't hear it. And he couldn't bring the case in federal court because he didn't have that registration. And the publishing company knew this. So they basically, thumbed their nose at him and said, you can't do anything. We can publish this work, even though it's technically illegal. So that's why the registration is so important, especially if you're going to self-publish, because you don't, there's a lot of companies out there, and there's some that are very good and very reputable, and there's some that aren't, and you don't always know ahead of time what you're getting into. And you want that, like I said, it's sort of like insurance. You want to have that ability to bring a suit if you need it.
That makes a lot of sense. I hate that story. I love it and I hate it. I love it because it's very instructive, but I hate it because it makes me feel so bad for this guy.
It was very frustrating to watch and not, it's like, just can't do anything. That's the way it is, and it's very, very frustrating.
Yes, I just hate injustice, and especially injustice against the elderly. It just makes me sad. So thank you for that. Any other questions, you guys? It's a very quiet group today. We're all probably eating our sandwiches behind our microphones. And anybody have a question for Aurelia?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
You can?
Yes.
Fantastic. I do have a question. Okay, I'm hung up as well on the using someone's likeness. I have fictional people in a fictional city, but let's say they wanted to get interviewed by, like, the Today Show or something like that. That's something then I would have to create a fictional Today Show and make sure I don't have anyone who looks like Matt Lauer or anybody like that. Is that what you're saying? Or
So this starts to get into kind of a gray area. So I can't really give, like, a yes-no answer, but what I can do is go back to what the rules are, because this is where you really need to – this is tough because – in this situation, I can't give full-out legal advice like, yes, do X, no, do Y. In these kind of gray areas where you could argue one way or the other. But the main thing you want to focus on is, because this is an area where you're dealing with famous people, just focus on it needs to be true, or it needs to not be placing them in a bad light. Because you're looking at, when you're dealing with famous people, your concern is that you don't want to defame them, and you don't want to appropriate their likeness for your benefit. So defaming means that you're saying something that harms their reputation and is untrue and that you with famous people and that you did it on purpose. So if you don't have all three of those things, then you don't have a defamation issue. So if you're not showing them in a bad light right there, you don't have that one, so you don't have defamation. And then on the appropriation, you want to look at, am I putting this in here to benefit from their likeness? If it's a scene in your book, I would say the chances of that are low. Obviously, somebody would have to look at the whole situation to give an accurate answer. But if this is part of your story and what's happening, just make sure that the way it's going about, and that it's not, you're not using it just for your benefit to try to, this book is all, this character goes to the Today Show, and everybody who loves Matt Lauer should totally buy this book because of that. Not that kind of thing.
Well, nothing like that, but definitely just making sure, like you said, not in a good light, because I think part of it is I am trying to play the idea of the media, so I will have to be careful because there's, not the Today Show and Matt Lauer, but, let's say Fox News or something like that. I would have to be careful about how I would use something like that.
Right, and you just want to keep those three things in sight. So not in a good light, and that it's not true, and that for somebody famous, that you're doing it to harm them. So you just want to watch those three. Like I said, it's really, really difficult for a famous person to win a defamation suit because it's often difficult for them to show that malice part, that intent to harm. So you just want to keep those three things in mind as you work on it.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you. We probably have time for one short question. So if anybody has a short question and they're like sitting there going, oh, man, I really want to ask my question.
This is Christy, and I was asking more about the blog. I have 75 entries up on Blogspot, and everything's dated and everything, but I'm writing some books too. if anybody's going to copy anything off of there and I used it in my books, what kind of problems might I have?
You're saying if you're using your own work in your book, but somebody's copied it from your blog?
Right.
So,
I mean, how far back would the copyright cover, since if I did it now, I started in 2010?
Right. So once it's in your book, if you've got the registration on your book, then you've copied that. Now, part of showing a copyright infringement claim is showing that somebody copied. That's because you're asking, like, if you needed to go to court, would you be able to?
No. I'm just asking about getting it copyrighted, what all's going to be covered once I do of things that I've already written and published online.
So when you copyright something, you get the copyright in that thing. So, for example, if you copyright your book, it covers everything in that book.
Mm-hmm.
But
blog,
not necessarily the blog.
No. Now, some of that stuff might be the same, but it would, you would, if you wanted to copyright the or get the registration for the blog, you can register a blog. You would submit a different registration form for the blog itself. Now, stuff that's the same, it's in your book, it's covered under the book, but there's getting in a little too deep. There's sort of this issue of once you start getting into things like fair use, which is where people are allowed to use things that would otherwise be protected for certain situations and certain meeting certain requirements. One of those things is how much of the work was used. So if it's part of a book, that might be a smaller, it might be a smaller amount than if it was the blog post.
Uh-huh.
That makes sense. So you could get into some things there. But generally on something like that, I mean, the book's the area where you're going to be most concerned in terms of a registration. Remember, everything is copyrighted. And for most people, if they're taking something they shouldn't be and you contact them, especially if they're not intricately familiar with copyright law, you can approach them and explain that, you know, you're unhappy and that they shouldn't be doing this and that this violates the law. And you can have an attorney approach them for that. And generally you'll get a good response, at least.
Right.
I mean, I can't say everybody does, but I find that, at least in my experience, when I'm working with people, it's more of the innocent infringer. It's people not realizing that they shouldn't have done what they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I see that a lot with blogs. Thanks for your question, that people will take other people's blog posts without citing who wrote it. And it's kind of like, ugh. So it's a lot of work for you guys, writers. Thanks, everybody, for your great questions. Aurelia, do you have a final piece of wisdom to offer our listeners?
Yeah, I would say you guys are writers, so focus on the writing. And when you get into this stuff, you know, you just don't want to deal with it because it's legal stuff, just have an attorney do it. It'll make your life easier.
Perfect. Aurelia, this has been great. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you, Rochelle. And thanks, everybody, for calling in.
I want to let you know that our guest has been Aurelia J. Schultz. She's a member of the Wisconsin and California State Bar. Visit her online at www.schultzlaw.us. If you're a member of this mastermind group, you're going to be getting a link to her website and her services when I send out the recording. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this has been the Right Now Mastermind class. Keep writing, guys. Take care. Have a good month. Bye-bye.